Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome everyone to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. We hope and trust you had a wonderful Easter weekend. We are back now, the two of us finally together after a little over a week. He's Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, I know there are a few subjects you like to talk about more than your admiration and appreciation for Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. You spent a few days with him prior to his landslide reelection last year, last fall on the campaign trail. And one of the things he wanted to do then and has now accomplished is sweeping education reform, allowing vouchers to be available to a whole lot more people, making it tougher for teachers to get tenure. So that makes sure that good teachers actually are there long term and not just anybody who becomes a teacher. So I know you've studied this a lot more than I have. So how big is this and what does it tell us about Governor Jindal?
A couple of things worth noting here. In his first term, he had enacted some of the reforms he wanted, but he still had a very ambitious agenda. One of the things he had began what a lot of people would consider a voucher program. But he pointed out that when you call a voucher program, there are certain people who kind of get their hackles up. They kind of get unnerved by it or bothered by it. So it's called the Louisiana Scholarship Program. When you call it a scholarship program, which is what it is, basically giving poor students a stipend, an amount of money that they can use towards public school, private school, whatever tuition needs they have, lo and behold, a great deal of the opposition evaporates towards it. Last week, a big overhaul package got through the Louisiana legislature. A couple of the quick highlights. It expands the ways to create charter schools, lessens local school board authority in hiring and firing, expands online schools, some financing restructuring. But I think one of the things that really jumps out at me is that it begins a step towards making it harder for teachers to get tenure. And while I was out on break, the New Republic, of all folks, generally a left-of-center magazine, not a far-left magazine, but they basically were writing about the state of Virginia, and that there had been an effort in Virginia to eliminate teacher tenure. It did not succeed, but they pointed out that, look, the argument for tenure in higher education does not apply to public schools. And we can get into the nitty-gritty of that, but basically, public school teachers don't need the freedom of expression that comes for, or the guarantee of lifetime employment and research and to look into controversial. The purpose of higher education and the purpose of grade school and high school, elementary school education are quite different. And so the idea that after 3 years of working in the system or different states have different rules for tenure, the idea that you are pretty much guaranteed lifetime employment for all professions, it's kind of surprising and kind of strange and kind of isn't logical and has clearly been an obstacle to serious reform. Basically, if you are in an environment in which you are basically guaranteed employment for the rest of your life, as long as you don't screw up terribly, you don't have an enormous incentive to do a terrific job. You have, if mediocre is good enough in a lot of public schools, and that's exactly the mentality we need to fight. Jindal did not succeed in eliminating it, but basically makes it harder for them to qualify for it. And if you are a teacher who has been rated as substandard in some way, you have to meet a certain standard for like four consecutive years before you can qualify for tenure again. Unsurprisingly, the teachers' unions in Louisiana do not like this. They're promising lawsuits, et cetera. But the bottom line is I was very intrigued by this, and it struck me as another good way to put the Democratic Party on the side of teachers' unions and against parents, and to say, look, why should teachers get effectively a guarantee of lifetime employment? How can this possibly be an incentive towards good schools and good education? It's in most cases it has proven to be an impediment to this because it removes the accountability that that every child basically deserves. So kudos to Governor Jindal. This is only one step, but there's a lot more work ahead. But this is a big step in the right direction in a state whose education system really needed it before Jindal came on the scene.
We'll be watching. On to martini number two now, Jim. And James O'Keefe is back again. He is not personally the bad martini. What he has uncovered remains the bad martini. Just a few weeks ago, I talked to him after his video in Vermont, where he basically got access to any ballot he could have wanted. The way he does it is he says, do you have a fill in the blank with a name, and they offer him the ballot, and then he says he doesn't have the ID. They say they don't need it. Then he offers to go get it anyway, and that's how he gets out of illegally voting. But now he's taken this to another level. I asked him back after the Vermont video whether the Justice Department has taken any notice of this, and he said no, but stay tuned. And now we found out what he meant by that. And here's a little bit of a snippet from that video that just got released through Project Veritas and Breitbart.com.
A man walks into a poll location in Washington, D.C. and asks about United States Attorney General Eric Holder. The poll worker places a mark next to Eric Holder's name and offers the man Eric Holder's ballot to vote.
Hello. Do you have an Eric Holder?
Okay.
Last name?
Please sign me there.
I actually forgot my ID.
You don't need it, it's all right.
I left it in the car.
As long as you're in here, you're on our list, and that's who you say you are. Okay?
I would feel more comfortable if I just had my ID. It's all right if I go get
sure,
a car. I'll be back faster than you can say furious.
We're not going anywhere.
So he's got a little dig in there as well that the poll worker obviously didn't get. But later in the video, he has this series of quotes from Attorney General Eric Holder talking about the voter ID push.
But there is no proof that our elections are marred by in-person voter fraud. Solutions that have been proposed go to things that do not exist or go to a problem that does not exist.
Well, if Eric Holder couldn't get his own ballot, you'd think, Jim, if anything's going to get his attention, that would. My guess is he'll probably try to figure out where James O'Keefe broke the law instead.
Yeah, exactly. This has always been the response up in Vermont. A couple of things are kind of fascinating about this. One is, I mean, I voted in D.C. for a couple of years, and I never quite thought through. I mean, I always thought it was weird that they never asked me for my ID. But basically what this proves is that if you know someone's name and address in the District of Columbia, you can go to the polling place and vote in their place. Extremely unnerving. I mean, if you think about it, you know anybody could vote for anyone else, and there's no effort at verification of this, as long as you have their current address and it's on the voter rolls. The other thing I found kind of fascinating about this is that the two D.C. ballot workers there, the name Eric Holder doesn't ring any bells to them at all. Like they don't even say, oh, boy, you must be getting a lot of, you know, a lot of attention these days. Or like you'd expect if somebody says, hi, my name is Eric Holder. Huh, boy, you've had a busy couple of years. You know, there's no recognition of that name whatsoever. And this is not like out in the middle of nowhere. This is in the District of Columbia. Right. You'd think if anybody would have a slightly more familiarity with who the attorney general is. And Eric Holder has not been a low profile. This is not, you know, Michael Mukasey kind of was a slightly more lower profile than some of his predecessors and folks. But Eric Holder's been in the middle of several huge controversies. Nobody pays attention to this. So that's bizarre and strange. I think this deserves enormous attention from the rest of the media. We'll have to see if the Washington Post or anybody does it. But you have to salute James O'Keefe for knowing how to make a big splash. And this is a fantastic illustration of this. I suppose that the rules probably in Chicago are slightly better. Huh. It would be tough to impersonate President Obama. But there's probably, you know, other folks, other celebrities who you could impersonate, and it sounds like in subsequent videos they'll be looking at that. So this is a egregious practice in the District of Columbia that must be fixed. Not that we ever expect Republicans to ever win in the District of Columbia, but voter fraud anywhere is bad news for concepts of democracy and the rule of law. And I think it's just a great, vivid illustration that what the Democrats have been insisting is not a concern is a very serious and legitimate concern indeed.
And hats off to O'Keefe, despite all the threats from Democratic leaders. At least one chamber in New Hampshire passed voter ID legislation. I believe one chamber in Minnesota has as well. And so progress is being made. I'm not sure whether the D.C. City Council or Congress has control over D.C.'s voting laws, but either way, something needs to change. On to martini number three now, Jim. And we're all tired of war, but not necessarily the war that you might be thinking that we're talking about, since we obviously have been in military conflict in Afghanistan for over a decade and until very recently in Iraq as well. But it's the metaphorical wars that we're talking about here, the war on religious freedom, the war on women, the war on fill in the blank. And so Ralph Reed, former big shot at the Christian Coalition, was on CNN over the weekend, along with Emanuel Cleaver, head of the Congressional Black Caucus. This would be one of those moments over the weekend where the F-bomb was not dropped by a CNN reporter. Nonetheless, Mr. Reed was talking about how the Obama administration, through its mandates on contraception and other policies, have eroded religious rights. And so Mr. Cleaver responded to that by saying that sort of language was over the top. And he also talked about how he has defended Republicans against egregious comparisons as well.
Some Democrats called Governor Walker of Wisconsin Hitler. They likened him to Hitler and they held up posters. I'm a Democrat. I condemned that. Hitler killed 8 million people. Governor Walker is trying to kill a union. There's no comparison. And so that was wrong.
We can debate later whether Scott Walker's trying to kill a union, but that's apart from this conversation at the moment. He then went on to say that it's wrong to say that President Obama is declaring war on religion. So then Ralph Reed said this.
Is it similarly wrong then for Democrats to say that the Republican Party is engaged in a war on women? Is that wrong?
No. Yes, that is wrong, and I've never said it, not one time.
It's not often Emmanuel Cleaver gets pretty close to the good martini. It's kind of the crazy martini given all the over-the-top rhetoric here, Jim, but hopefully more people are listening to him.
Well, I will salute Congressman Cleaver for kind of, you know, saying that he tries to call out both sides. I think it probably would be better if we lived in a world with slightly less hyperbolic political rhetoric. Greg, in fact, I really believe it is time for a metaphorical war on metaphorical wars. This periodically bubbles up when people use martial analogies in politics. We all know the great hullabaloo about the use of alleged bullseyes in the map on Sarah Palin's website, which they, you know, ninnies complained was prompted the gunman out in Arizona. Look, everybody has always seen – look, politics is a form of conflict. And so it's not surprising that people look to other forms of conflict for metaphors, be it football games, be it baseball games. People say we're only in the third inning of our presidential race. And so it's not surprising. Having said that, when you define someone else as the enemy, you can't usually compromise with them. You can't – you know, we didn't want to win 7/10 of our war against Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan and so on. It's kind of intriguing that the famous documentary about the Clintons' campaign in 1992 was entitled The War Room. You kind of think that for presidents, the war room was where actual wars were fought. Thinking of Dr. Strangelove, you can't fight in here, gentlemen. This is the war room. That there's a certain argument to be said, look, if we're going to try to have a more civil discourse, if we want to have times where we can unify as Americans, we need to not see each other as the enemy, and thus we should avoid these things. This rule tends to only be applied to the other guys, not to our guys. So I'll salute Cleaver for saying that he opposes declaring Republicans have war on women. Sure, Ralph Reed is a little hyperbolic on this. Either side wants to unilaterally disarm. And so I doubt we will ever see a more civil political discourse in which there's less use of war. So if you want to see a rhetorical peace, Greg, we must prepare for rhetorical war. And so I have my stockpiles of martial metaphors up ready to deploy. And I'm a DEFCON 5, you could say.
So. There you go. Jim, welcome back. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.